Okay, it is 9 o'clock, so we will begin officially our panel this morning. And again, I want to thank the panelists for coming and spending time with us today. I'm going to first, they have a mic, a handheld mic, and they're going to pass it down. I'm going to first have the panelists introduce themselves and tell us how many years they taught at EMU. And we will start here.
Yes, I'm Millard Showalter, and I taught at EMU for 32 years.
And I am Galen Lehman, and I just finished teaching here 39 years.
Kenton Brubaker, 33.
Glenn Kaufman, 38.
Claire Mellinger, 37.
Joe Mast, I taught 1 year at EMHS and 37 at EMC.
Now, Millard, of course, is the mathematician, and so I asked him, I wanted to know if he could still add. So I asked him to add these years up, and we'll take a shot, and he's going to tell us how many years this was.
They say there are two kinds of mathematics teachers. I mean, three kinds of mathematics teachers. Those that can count and those that can't, you know which kind I am. But I got 166, roughly. We'll check it out.
Okay. All right. I have a series of questions, and we'll just simply move down. We're going to start with Millard first on the first question. And on the second question, we're going to start with Galen, and on the third question, we're going to start with Kenton. And they'll just go consecutively down and on around. So the first question is this. What led to your arrival at EMU as a professor? Tell us a little bit about your educational background, how you moved into your role. What in world impelled you to come to this place?
Well, first of all, correction. I went over the figures again. I think it was 266 years. That's more like it, isn't it? Well, you wonder how in the world I ever got here. I graduated from EMC as it was then back in 1962. I taught for mathematics at Christopher Dock High School for the next 3 years, and then received a National Science Foundation scholarship to begin a master's program at the University of South Carolina, which I completed in the summer of 1966. But in the spring of 66, I got a telephone call from Dean Ira Miller asking if I would consider a teaching position in mathematics at EMC. Well, I was honored to receive such an offer, and I gladly accepted, even though I would be making less money than I would if I had returned to Christopher Dock. But it was a good choice. I thoroughly enjoyed my 32 years here of teaching. I had a lot of fun. And if I were to go back and face that same decision again, I would certainly choose to come to EMU. It was a great ride.
I came here to EMU in the fall of 1969 as a student, psychology major. One of the things that helps mark that year is that that was the year of the library drive and all of the things that were associated with that. 4 years in the psychology department, I never considered the possibility of a teaching career. But when I was a senior, my mentor, John Henry Hess, suggested one time to me, he said, Galen, you know, you have some skills of a teacher. Have you ever considered teaching? And it never crossed my mind. And so I thought about it a while, and sure enough, that's the direction that my career took. After teaching 1 year, or actually maybe more than 1 year, I went on, got a master's degree in psychology from Hollins University. And then during my first sabbatical year, got my PhD from Virginia Tech. And since that time, enjoyed the experience of working with students and faculty here. One of the unique things about my role among these folks is that I barely made it under the wire to qualify as a retired person. But the difference between myself and all of these is every one of them were my professors. And I benefited greatly by their teaching experience in showing me how to teach and then also teaching along with them and them mentoring me as a young professor very early in my career.
When I was a student at Lancaster Mennonite School, I read a book by I.W. Mumaw called Agricultural Missions. And my buddies wanted to, my good friends all wanted to become medical doctors. And I said, I think I'm more interested in keeping people from getting sick than taking care of them after they're sick. And so I decided I'm going to go into agricultural missions. To do that, I studied biology here at EMU and then won my senior year at Cornell in agronomy and my graduate work at horticulture at Ohio State. After I got my doctorate, I was looking for a mission opening. There didn't seem to be any. I'd gone to Puerto Rico to look at the Ulrich Foundation. That didn't seem to work out. And then Ira Miller came to visit me at Ohio State and invited me to come, and that's how I got here.
I started college here in 1956. Chemistry was the only physical science major at that time. And my freshman professor, general chemistry, was Henry Weaver, Jr. And at the end of that year, he put the bug in my head that I should think about graduate school at some point. I'd never given it a thought before that. He left at the end of that year, and the chemistry program sort of, I don't know, limped along for a while. I think I was actually invited to stay on and teach after I graduated. But I said I was going to graduate school. And they could wait, which they did. So I returned in 1965 after my doctoral work at the University of Pennsylvania. Came here with Lewis Brubaker, who had just gotten his PhD at Northwestern. So go from zero PhDs to two in one fell swoop. Unfortunately, he was a Canadian here on a student visa and had to leave after 1 year. And so, as things devolved, I became the de facto head of the department, whether I wanted to or not. And the rest is history, I guess.
I just want to mess with Millard's numbers again a little bit. I actually taught 38 years. I was sort of like Glenn. When I graduated in 1964, which is why, with Joe Woods, why we have these funny name tags today. The biology faculty all ran off. Kenton went to the Congo, and Carl Keener was back in graduate school, and Merle Jacobs took off for Goshen. And they asked me to teach labs the next year. Dr. Suter and D. Ralph Hostetter were the only two biology, and so they taught the courses, and I taught the labs mostly for that year after I graduated. During that year, with the help of Carl Keener and some other people, I applied to a bunch of graduate schools and got accepted, and like the thrifty Mennonite that I am, sort of, I took the one that gave me the biggest financial package and took off for University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and got my PhD there. I don't remember whether I ever thought about coming back to EMC or not, but during one summer, Kenton and Jim Brumberger showed up in Chapel Hill. They were in a summer program that they were doing supplementary courses down there. And after that, Kenton kept writing me and asking me to come back to EMU. And after Harvard and MIT refused to answer my letters, and I decided that I'd come back here and teach and enjoyed my years here.
I arrived at EMU in the fall of 1960, right after Glenn left, and the chemistry department wasn't empty. Louis Brubaker was there, and he was a marvelous teacher. I had a good high school chemistry course. And we took some kind of standardized test at the end of the year. And the dean called me in and said, you know, you have to change your major to chemistry. And I said, no way. I had a goal to be a physics teacher in high school. That's what I was going to do. I quickly joined the Astral Society and WEMC staff. Two things that were very dear to my heart. And if EMU had had a pre-engineering program, of course, I would have done that. But my guidance counselor thought I should go into engineering, but then I wouldn't have been able to go to EMC, so everybody went to EMC where I grew up. Anyway, the next year, when I was a sophomore, Jim Mullinex and Robert Lehman showed up. I had Robert Lehman for physics, and in my senior year, I was asked to teach the physics class at EMHS. And by the way, my major was mathematics and secondary education. At the end of my senior year, I, along with the other seniors, at that time they made the seniors take the GREs. I guess it was a way of trying to evaluate the college program. Anyway, I kind of blew the lid off of them. And so even though I had agreed to teach at EMHS the next year, which I did, I taught physics and math and general science and earth science and stuff like that. By October, I'd pretty well decided I was going to follow my interest in astronomy. And I applied for government fellowships, and I was awarded fellowships at both schools that I applied to, and I decided to go to UVA. And that's where I spent the next 3 years. It was interesting teaching PSSC physics. That was the new physics program for the Race to the Moon. And by the way, my fellowship was Race to the Moon, too. Compliments of John F. Kennedy. I didn't realize it at the time, but I think my college mentor, Robert Lehman, had a personal goal to start a physics major at EMC. I think he also saw me as a possible M.T. Brackbell. In any case, 3 years later, the new physics major was approved. I'd completed my coursework. I'd also obtained all the research data I needed for my dissertation. I was studying the interstellar hydrogen gas in the Milky Way, in the local region of the sun. EMU reached out to me. Myron was now the president. Roy Heatwell, who was here today in our class of 64, he had just been drafted. I didn't get drafted. I had a student deferment. So this is the way the cards play, right? And that was the last year before the lottery. My age was such that I didn't qualify. I was the next year. If I'd have been a year younger, I'd have been in the lottery and I'd have been day number 5. At any rate, EMU had a new science building. I went to EMHS the year they had a new building. I went to EMU the year that there was a new science building. I moved into the campus center the year there was a new campus center. But more about the renovations a little bit later. In any case, there was a new M.T. Brackwell Planetarium and a new computer. A government grant from NSF gave small colleges who applied a computer to see what in the world they would do with it. And so the computer arrived, I arrived, the planetarium arrived. John Horst and Robert Lehman and I, we were the new physics department, and I taught a class at EMHS in computer programming, because of course you couldn't do it in the college. They can't make courses up in 30 days. It's not possible. So anyway, the computer stuff will be delayed. I'll talk about that later. I also gave planetarium programs and taught mathematics and physics, and that's the rest is history.
Okay, thank you. We'll go for our second round, starting with Galen. And the question is, share one highlight or reflection on your tenure as a professor or faculty person. Galen.
One? I'll say several, but I'll keep them very short. Joe mentioned the purchase of the first mainframe computer early in my career of teaching. I think it was in either the first or second year in the psychology department, we purchased the first desktop computer. It was an Apple II. Along with Dave Glanzer and I, we started doing programming on it and started using it for instructional purposes in the classroom and so on. And that Apple II computer is still in a closet back here in the psychology department, and it has a very, very low serial number. I don't know, someday it may be worth something. Soon after that, another highlight was, a huge highlight was moving from what was known as the turkey hatchery across Mount Clinton Pike, way up on the hill. Actually, at one time, it was a car dealership as well. But then EMU was able to buy the property and so on, changed it in the psychology department. But we felt like we were really on the fringes. In 1981, psychology department was able to move here to the Science Center in the area where immediately behind where we're at now. And that felt like a real step up. We had arrived as another part of the legitimate sciences. Another brief highlight is over the years applying for different grants and so on, we had a grant that allowed us to work with autistic kids. We called the program Family Care. Don Oswald was instrumental in that kind of work. He graduated from here, worked in with autistic kids. I was teaching applied behavior analysis, and together we worked at designing a program that we could help our students learn how to work with autistic kids. Another highlight was then collaborating with many different persons on work like Dave Glanzer and I designed the first software that EMU had that was called PsychLearn, and later that was picked up and distributed nationally with the textbook that we were using at the time. And so there were quite a few things like that that were very exciting and cutting edge as far as I'm concerned.
So I'll rephrase the question to say plural highlights, as long as you stay in your time.
I'm going to give a little background for my reflection, and that is after I came to EMC, because I couldn't find a mission assignment, I decided to start the agricultural missions major at EMU, and that had been one of my early concerns. But what's interesting to me is that when I came here, I taught all kinds of things, and I keep wondering how it is that I could teach genetics, cell biology, biochemistry as a horticulturist. But nevertheless, I did, and the highlight is this. A couple years ago, I talked to one of my former students. Many times my former students will say, I remember I had you in a class, I don't remember what the class was, but that's okay. But Kenton Swartz I've talked with, and Kenton said, I do remember the course that I want to talk about. And that's cell biology. Again, why was a horticulturist teaching cell biology? Because I was just so fascinated with all the new things that were happening in biology that that's what I wanted to do. And so we had a textbook, and Kenton says, I you went through that textbook with us, and he said, that's the point that I decided I wanted to go into research. So he applied at Harvard, and he could have gone to an MD, but he said, I'm going to because I'm going to go for a PhD and do research. So to me, that was a highlight to see that one of my students who could remember a course that he had taken, and that this was an important thing in his career. And so I looked him up the other day in the computer, and entry after entry under Kenton Swartz, what he's doing here in NIH and so forth, and here he is in the forefront of research. And not many of our students are in the forefront of research after a PhD at Harvard.
One of my interests in teaching has to do somewhat with my philosophy of science, and that is that, that science is an active thing. It's not a study of stored facts. And so I was committed to doing some kind of research from day one, and it took a while, but I started in 65, and by the time friends of mine said I wouldn't last here 3 years, but what happened after 3 years is that this science center was opened, and we finally had facilities to do research, and I got two grants for initiating a research program here on campus at about that same time, and we were able to start compiling some instrumentation, which is necessary, and that was one of the highlights of my career, was working with students in the research lab. Students would do independent studies, and it was always a struggle because it was generally on top of a full teaching load of classes, but I think we sort of developed a culture of student research in our department, not the only department that was doing research, but that definitely was a highlight part of my career.
A lot of us, when you teach, I tell my friends, when you teach at a small college, you get to teach a lot of things you really shouldn't be teaching. Like Kenton, but especially if at EMU, if you're a field biologist, you get to teach a lot of things because most of the courses are designed towards pre-professional health programs, and so there aren't a whole lot of field biology courses, and they often run every other year, and so you have a lot of things to fill in your resume. One of the things I probably shouldn't have taught, but I enjoyed the couple years was nutrition. I forgot to say I'm actually a plant ecologist, but I did teach nutrition. But I don't think any of my students ever got into Harvard with nutrition. But one of the highlights was when I came to EMU. I was perfectly aware that the focus of the biology department was in pre-professional health, as Roman calls it, and not in ecology or environmental science or botany or any of those things. And I was not disillusioned about that, and I got along with that fine. But one of the highlights of, as I look back, was the development of, within the biology department, of an ecological environmental science program, and eventually an environmental science major. And one of the first things that, and that, one of the first steps in that direction was back in the 70s, and I think it started actually before I got here, but We used to have all school conferences where the whole school for a week or 2 weeks, was it 2 weeks? I think maybe it was 2 weeks sometimes. We would all get together and study the same thing. And in the early 70s, soon, a couple years after I got here, I think it was 72, we had Earth survival. That was in the days of population boom and ecological crisis days. And so that was sort of the emphasis of that whole conference. And it was a very good conference. But at any rate, out of that arose a number of professors and students got together and said, we really ought to do something practical. And out of that arose the organization called Earth Keepers. And Kenton and Burl Brubaker in nursing, Mary Martin in nursing, and myself and a lot of students developed the Earth Keepers, and where we started paper recycling and started collecting newspapers all over town and then recycling them, taking them down to Richmond to be reused, made into shoe boxes probably, but we put a lot of effort into that. And that was sort of, that developed over the years. Eventually the business department took over the Earth Keepers as sort of an intern or a practicum for their business majors. But that was sort of the first step in the development of more of an environmental ecological approach program within the biology department. And that was one of the highlights. That was probably a looking back kind of highlight as something I really we planned to do.
My primary highlight is the answer to the next question, so I'm going to pass on that. And Roman gave us 4 minutes to talk about one highlight and 2 minutes to introduce ourselves, so I just kind of flipped those. But anyway, one of the real highlights of being on the faculty is working with all these other people. If I look back at my years at EMU and EMC and think about, what's the most standout? It's just an unbelievable community to work in with the faculty and the staff. But I'm going to talk about a few other things. My favorite class was Introduction to Astronomy. In my case, I had two goals in that class. The first one was to teach enough observational astronomy that if people go out 10 years, 15 years later and they look up in the sky, they recognize Orion, for example. That sort of thing. And the second one was, I thought that descriptive astronomy course was probably the ideal class to teach how science works. And so I emphasized not the mathematical side of astronomy, but the more philosophical and interesting side of astronomy. So I suppose many of you saw the eclipse of the moon on Wednesday morning, and the rest of you didn't even know it happened. but that's the sort of thing that, how those things work. So why is astronomy good for how science works? Well, because everybody thought the Earth was the center of the universe. And they built a really good model that made it work. Ptolemy did that about 2,000 years ago. And then along comes Galileo and Copernicus, and they decided that model it didn't fit that. That old model was busted. So we bring up a new model. Well, the new model lasts for a couple hundred years, and then it breaks. And then that model breaks, and we go from the Earth as a center to the Sun as a center to the Milky Way as a center to now, the center, we don't know where it is, but it's nowhere as near where we are, that's for sure. Anyway, other highlights, the public school planetarium program. Can you imagine how much fun it is to interact with third and fourth graders and talk about Galileo and Copernicus and how we know that the Earth really does go around the Sun. I also was involved in the credit union. Back in 1968, the year that I arrived, Dan Bender arrived from Heston. Well, hey guys, where's the credit union? Don't you guys know where the world is working? And so he planted the seed, Robert Lehman picked up the ball. Myron Augsburger was president. He gave us the green light. And a credit union was born. It was in the Science Center office, right over here, where it's still the same place. By the time that when we signed up, the first five people to sign up were the five charter members. There were actually seven charter members. But Bob and I were so busy running around doing stuff, we never got to sign up till we were in the 20s somewhere. But we eventually got signed up. When I left EMU in 1971, went back to UVA and finished my PhD. And when I returned, the Science Center became, the credit union moved from the Science Center office to my office, which was right out here around the corner, SC44. Yesterday morning, I was taking an unsupervised tour with Gerald Brunk, and I'm standing there looking at my door, which is just a bunch of blocks. There's no door there anymore. Walked around the wall, there's a classroom. So I don't know where SC44 will be when this is done, if there will be one, but it won't be the place where the credit union was for 10 years. It's gone. That history is gone. microcomputers started showing up. That's another highlight. And I spent a good bit of time in the lab and a lot of times working with students that weren't my students. And because of that effort, I ended up being the first faculty member to get the Quality Service Award. When that program started, it generally was staff, and somehow I got stuck in there, and since then other people too. So lots of things happen. It's a great place to work.
Joe forgot to, when he was saying this is a great place to work because of the faculty and the staff and so forth, and forgot to say, and also the students are fun to work with too. One of my colleagues said, when I asked him why he came to EMU, this was before I came, why he came back to EMU, and he said he likes what the students become after they go through EMU, and that's pretty good reason.
Well, thank you, Claire. That leads right into what I want to share. The highlight that I would like to share this morning is the fact that I had some very interesting, very intelligent, very creative students. And let me just share one example. Each year, I would teach several sections of a course entitled Mathematics in the Liberal Arts. At the beginning of the semester, the very first period, I would often offer students a non-traditional way of earning an A for the course. I announced that anyone who would bring in an 8.5 by 11 sheet of copy paper that had been folded over 8 times would automatically get an A for the course. I got away with that for a number of years, but eventually I had to stop making that offer. Before I tell you why, let's think about the mathematics involved in this little problem. You fold it over once, it's 2 thicknesses. Twice, 4, 3 times 8, then 16, 32, 64, 128. The 8th fold would make 256 thicknesses. If you think of a ream of 500 sheets of copy paper, it's about that high, this would be half of that, about an inch. And I was convinced, I had tried it, it was impossible. I did not have enough strength to make that last fold. Now, I always emphasize problem solving in my classes, and this was a very good problem to push further, extend. Instead of just taking a paper and folding it over, think of having a large sheet of paper 1/500th of an inch thick, meaning you'd have to have 500 sheets to be an inch high. Instead of folding, we'll just cut and stack, and we do that 50 times. How high would the stack be? Now, in problem solving, it's good to think through the problem, make some guesses, to think where the answer may come out. So I would have students make guesses. And I would write the guesses up on the board. And usually the answers were in terms of inches and feet. But once in a while, some brave soul would call out a mile or two. And the whole class would erupt in laughter at such a ridiculous answer. And then I'd work the problem out on the board. And it turns out that the height is more than 35.5 million miles. Well, people couldn't believe it. Some students whipped out their calculator to check to see if I'd made a mistake. Well, why did I quit making this offer for an A? Well, one year, the second period of the class of the semester, after I had made that offer the first period, this student comes breezing into the classroom, dashes over to where I was standing, and hands me a wad of paper. I could tell by the look in his eyes that I was in big trouble. So I took the wad and started counting as it unfolded. Sure enough, it had been folded 8 times. I couldn't believe it. What was I going to do? Well, after some prodding, he confessed that he had a part-time job at Kreider's Machine Shop, where they have these presses for bending metal with some 200 tons of pressure. And he had used this press to make the folds in the paper. Well, certainly any student who had such problem-solving strategies and abilities should certainly get an A in a math course, don't you think? Well, let me assure you, he did. But he earned it in his own right as well. Now, I know you're just dying to know who this student is, and I'm glad to tell you it was none other than one of the panel members seating here in front of you, Dr. Galen Lehman.
The next question, and we will begin with this distinguished panelist, will answer a question about change. And so it's a very broad question. What are some of the changes in your department during the time you spent here? What was your involvement? It could be changes in teaching strategies that you personally did or experienced, anything dealing with change or movement. Galen. Oh, I'm sorry. You're starting with Kenton?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Okay.
One change I think we'll see, if we have this kind of panel in 30 years, it'll be women instead of men. But anyway, that's the way it is. So much has happened in biology, it's impossible not to change. I remember going to my professor, who was going to be in my committee, ask him, how am I going to catch up on genetics because of all that has been happening? And Dr. Varner told me, he said, go to Scientific American and read all the materials that have happened from Watson Crick on. And that was a very helpful thing. But so much has happened in biology that it's bound that things would change tremendously. One thing I want to pick out is the philosophical idea of evolution. EMC was more or less started to keep us from believing in evolution. You were not supposed to do that. I certainly would have been taught that in high school and so on. And yet, as we looked more and more at what is going on in biology and learned more about what was happening, I came to the realization that evolution was one of the greatest ideas that God ever had, to actually develop a system which could correct itself and modify itself through time was something that no one else had really gotten done. And so I got the feeling that that is probably one of the major attributes of this great intelligence who was behind biology. The other thing that I would mention is that when I was a student at EMC, I never knew there was a thing like a research journal. We were never told about research journals. When I went to Cornell as a senior, I discovered the library. This was an amazing thing to me, and I discovered research journals in the library. And they had a contest there that you could write a research paper as an undergraduate. I think I was the first person at Cornell that ever did it, but I went to the library and wrote a research journal on the plant hormones and submitted it. And I think I was the first person that ever sent one in, and so they gave me the second prize, which was $20, I think. But anyway, they could hardly believe that, you know, an undergraduate could do this kind of thing, I guess, but I was so excited about that sort of thing. And so that is one of the things that I think had happened at EMU, that we moved from being a school that knew very little about what's going on in science to a university, and I think that is a major change.
Yeah, things change rapidly in chemistry. I could talk about a lot of things, but just the equipment kinds of things over the years. Starting out, we hooked up glassware in chemistry with cork stoppers. Today, you'd probably lose your job if you synthesize diethyl ether with cork connections. And it was amazing we had as few fires as we did. And open flame Bunsen burners for heating it. So we start there. Soon after, we started getting ground glass joints, which fit very nicely. And then around 89 or 90, particularly for the organic lab, a college developed a micro-scale program for the labs in which you used about 1/100th the amounts that had been used traditionally. And they developed a whole set of mini-scale glassware to go along with that. By this time, there was a good bit of instrumentation so that you could analyze small quantities, gas chromatographs, spectroscopy, and the like, and that really revolutionized organic chemistry labs. The organic chemistry lab was no longer the smelliest lab in the building. That was on the other side. The anatomy lab. Also, computerization, of course. Over the years, we gradually built up a supply of instrumentation, spectrometers. We got a nuclear magnetic resonance spectrometer. And again, in the 90s, there was sort of a revolution in which the instrumentation became computerized. This was very nice in many ways, not so nice in that students could no longer take the instruments apart and put them back together again and see exactly what was happening. Not much you can do with a motherboard other than order a new one. Even the technicians don't know how to fix them. And part of that evolution then with instrumentation, particularly in the 90s, we started a good bit of collaboration with JMU. The National Science Foundation was interested in supporting programs in which institutions collaborated with each other rather than each one developing their own programs, and we were able to participate in the setting up the Shenandoah Valley NMR Consortium, in which was housed, is housed at JMU, with high field nuclear magnetic resonance, which we could never afford here. Couldn't afford the maintenance, let alone paying $300,000 or $400,000 for the instrument itself, and that has given us state of the art access to that kind of analytical work, and also they also supported a research program. NSF during the 90s began a series of research programs called Research Experience for Undergraduates, and these would be housed at universities, and undergraduate students from colleges could apply for summer research experience, and JMU got one of these, and their program was somewhat unique. They do not have a graduate program in chemistry. They've avoided that so far, and but what they did was set up their undergraduate research program to include professors from neighboring colleges, and so I participated in the summer as a research mentor for several years, and that involves taking students from here and also students from elsewhere that might have applied for the program. So that has given us gave us a lot of access to facilities right across town. Biggest problem, finding a parking place.
One of the things that has evolved in the biology, or the science department in general, which isn't on my script here, but I just thought of, so currently, the general education program and the relationship of science to the general education program, over the years, we have periodically, if you're here 30 or more years, this happens periodically, is a review of the general education program. And one of the questions always is, how much science should be required? And the question is not only what kind of science, how much, but what science should be, should everybody take a chemistry course? Should everybody take a biology course? Should everybody take Joe's astronomy course? And the answers to all those questions were yes, of course, but it wasn't possible. And so I don't know exactly what's going on now. There might have been something happened, but in that the end, it evolved that we actually had no science required of everybody. There was no general science requirement, although most people took science in excuse me, for some requirement in their major. But the question that always bothered me was I could never decide exactly what it was that they should take. What is it that everybody should know about science, you know, and what kind of course would you design to make that not only worthwhile but interesting and challenging, and recruit students from all the other majors down here to the Science Center? But that's a big question, and if you have the answer to that question, why, I'm sure a lot of us would be glad to know after you, but you can wait after. At any rate, Roman had said, you know, you talk about the evolution, you might look at the general biology program. The general biology program has changed a lot over the years, but it seems to go sort of like this, up and down. There's lots of questions like, should everybody take a biology course? Should the people who take a biology course, should the biology majors take a different general biology course in the freshman year than they did, than the biology majors, than the non-majors? When I came,
there was a two-semester course taught by Kenton and Carl Keener, and 8 hours of biology. I think almost everybody had to take that, except the education majors, I think, had their own biology course. And then later, when we got to, some of you may remember the three-semester program that we were on, that when I came, that we had actually a trimester kind of system, in which there was a bioscience one and a bioscience two, and everybody took those were part of the gen ed program, or the at least bioscience one was, as I recall. I don't recall everything correctly anymore these days, but I think that was. And then we switched to a semester system, and we had human biology, where biology majors and phys ed majors and a few took the 8 hours of biology over two semesters. And now we had concepts of biology, which all majors take, but not the non-science majors take a bioscience course, which is seems to work fine, but there are so many factors that play into these decisions that are made that I'm inclined to think maybe they're not all that important, and things change over the year back and forth. But those are the one of the things I think that has changed over the year and will continue to change, and probably have changed since I've left.
In 1965, in my first semester of graduate work at UVA, one of my classes was a one-hour intro to computers. That opened up for me a whole new arena in my academic development, and probably if I hadn't had the fellowship and I had lots of money, I probably just switched majors, except there was no major in computers, not for another 5 years at least. But anyway, I came in 1968, the brand new physics major, just started, and it wasn't more than about 7 or 8 years when the Mennonite Board of Education decided that we shouldn't have two physics majors among the colleges. There are not enough students. So it was decided that EMU would drop its physics program. I spent my first sabbatical, and actually every sabbatical that I had at EMU, studying computer science. And when I returned after my first sabbatical, I proposed that EMU offer a new 2-year associate in science degree in computer processing. This proposal was submitted in November, and it was rejected. About 2 months later, the dean came back from a conference where it was stated that the next hot thing in higher education is computer science. And it didn't take more than about a month and a half before there was a full-page ad in the Gospel Herald. That fall, there were additional courses. Computer science was included in the math department. And it would take several more years before there was a full-blown 4-year major in computer science. And our major was the standard recommended major for colleges, not the more compact computer science major for small colleges. We did the whole thing. Mathematics department became the mathematical sciences department. I'm not exactly sure when that name change occurred. I also completed my Master of Computer Science degree at UVA. It was a few more years before the 2-year program that I started became a 4-year program in the business department. And a new IBM 36 computer was purchased for the exclusive use of the business program. Alongside these 2- and 4-year programs, the Intro to Computers course arrived, and a whole bunch of Apple II computers. Faculty couldn't stand the dot matrix printer output from those early years. And so in consultation with Galen Lehman and David Glanzer, we put a letter quality printer into the lab, and we charged students a per page amount for printing on it. For a number of years, I was like an Apple representative on campus. We had an Apple purchase program. Students could buy equipment through the university, and it all went through my office. And the program allowed us to buy discounted equipment for, you know, just to put out for show, like demonstration equipment. So soon a new letter quality laser printer arrived. And, you know, the computer science program is still rolling along today. I'll make a comment about the physics program. The physics major ended, and so that eliminated some classes, but that was compensated for by the addition of a pre-engineering program. And that program also is still exists today and continues.
I would like to talk about how my approach to teaching evolved over the years. There were five things that I tried to emphasize in my teaching. First, be enthusiastic. Second, use humor. Three, be prepared for class. I probably over-prepared since I tried to have my lectures memorized so I wouldn't be tied to notes. Four, use praise. It's amazing how far a little praise will go in motivating students to do the work. And five, demonstrate a sincere interest in your students. The challenge for me was to make math interesting, practical, and sometimes even exciting and fun. Now, it seemed there were always a few students who had gotten turned off on math long before coming to college, and it was difficult, sometimes impossible, to get them to change their attitudes. Now, I guess that was to be expected because there have always been people with negative attitudes about mathematics. You can go back to 400 AD. St. Augustine said, "The good Christian should beware of mathematicians and all those who make empty prophecies. The danger already exists that the mathematicians have made a covenant with the devil to darken the spirit and to confine man in the bonds of hell." In one of his books, Mark Twain had Huckleberry Finn to say, "I can say the multiplication table up to 6 times 7 is 35. And I don't reckon I could get any further than that if I was to live forever. I don't take no stock in mathematics anyway." And if you like to hear it in poetical form, Mephistopheles wrote to Faust, who was a math teacher, "Is it right, I ask, is it even prudence to bore thyself and bore thy students?" Well, with attitudes like that, I guess it wasn't surprising that I would have a few students who wouldn't be as excited about mathematics as I was. But I still tried to make math interesting for students. For the calculus students, there were always a lot of integration and differentiation formulas that they needed to know. Perhaps the hardest differentiation formula was the one to differentiate a function, which is the quotient of two other functions. The formula goes like this: the denominator times the derivative of the numerator, then subtract the product of the numerator times the derivative of the denominator, divide all that by the square of the denominator. Well, to make it easy for the students to remember, I suggested they think of the numerator as being high, H-I, the denominator is being ho, H-O, then d-high is the derivative of the numerator, d-ho, the derivative of the denominator, and then the formula is simply ho d-high minus high d-ho over ho-ho. You know, the amazing thing is, I still continue to run into previous calculus students who have forgotten a lot of their calculus, but they can still repeat ho di hi minus hi di ho over ho ho. For the non-science majors, for the students I had in mathematics and liberal art, I would usually begin the class period by giving a quiz over the homework that had been signed the period before. I found this to be a good motivator to get students to do the homework. And then for the students who would finish the quiz early, I would always have a for fun problem on the board for them to work on. And this problem usually required some non-traditional problem-solving strategies. Let me just share two problems, and then I'll shut up. James works in a butcher shop. He's 32 years old. He wears size 10 and a half shoes. What does he weigh? Right, he works in a butcher shop, so he weighs meat. A very logical deductive reason. Second one, Bonnie and Connie are sisters. They were born the same day, same week, same month, same year, had the same mother and the same father, yet they were not twins. How could that be? Well, that usually stumped the students too, so I'd give them a hint. Think of the names. Bonnie, Connie, Donnie. They had a brother. They were triplets.
Okay, for the sake of brevity, just quickly, a couple evolutionary changes that occurred during my time here. This relates to Kenton's comment about why there are no women here. When this building was designed and built, it only had one restroom for women up on the second floor. In 1981, when the psychology department moved into this building and I helped to redesign the facilities that we had, we were actually instrumental in getting adequate restrooms for women on both floors. And so maybe that will lead to more women being here the next time around. Another evolutionary change is class sizes. Can you imagine why this room was built the way it is? And how many people fit in here? 256. When is the last time there was a class of 256 students? Actually, that happened when I first started teaching here. We had classes that were known as interdisciplinary studies. All freshmen required to take them. I helped to team teach a class like that that met in this room. Every seat was full, plus we had chairs sitting up along the wall in the back to fill up this room, and there were five professors lined up here in the front to lecture week by week, teaching interdisciplinary studies. That's changed over the years. Another comment on change relating to computers and so on. I mentioned the very first computer that Dave Glanzer and I helped to buy, the Apple II. That computer, the internal memory was 16K. Not 16 megabyte, not 16 gigabyte, 16K. We thought we got a bargain when we bought that computer for $2,000. It had no disk drive. And the next year, after working with cassette tapes to record the programs that we made for that computer, we were able to buy a disk drive for that computer at a cost of $556. Now, just in terms of financial scale, think about that, the amount of money that cost. But to put things in perspective, my first year of teaching here at EMU full-time, my salary was $4,800. When I told that to some people, actually when I told it to my wife, she said, because I wasn't qualified to do what I was doing. Because she was actually making more than I was teaching at the high school. That has changed. That's enough changes.
I want to thank the panel for two things: the many years that you've given to EMU, and out here would sit many people who have appreciated your tutorage. Thank you also for coming today, and I appreciate the reflections, the sharing time. I'm going to dismiss you back, and we'll move to another part of the program.